for the arts. Learn more at arts.gov.
Tessie is the royal Rudy's rally cry. Tessie is the tune they always sung. Tessie echoed April through October night after Serenade installed in Aiden Young. Tessie is a maiden with a sparkling eye. Tessie is a maiden with a love. She doesn't know the meaning of her sight. She's got a comet full of love.
Oh, yeah, I've got to set the tone for this next conversation as we welcome back to the program friend of the show, David Krell, who's got a terrific new book out called The Fenway Effect, A Cultural History of the Boston Red Sox. David, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, it's such a wonderful book, and Bruce and I were talking earlier. You've done it again, and what you do so well is to wrap the story in baseball, but also talk a lot about what was going on culturally through the years. And it's about people, it's about the team, but it's about America as well. And you have done that again with this great new book.
That's very generous. I appreciate it.
One of the things that I most like about this, David, is that you broke it into five sections. Each of the section is a nonlinear section, and it makes us think about things in a way that isn't linear. And I've always found that's the most compelling writing, you know, whether it be fiction or nonfiction. It's not that it begins here, it ends here. How did you come about deciding which of these chapters went in which area?
Well, I have to thank my editor, Rob Taylor, from University of Nebraska Press. When I submitted my topic list, I had the table of contents set, and he said, well, this is all over the place. It needs some structure. So I said, geez, how am I going to do this? And I just sat down with a legal pad, and I tried to find different themes. So I had Ted Williams's speech at Cooperstown. I had the marathon bombing. I said, geez, these could probably go together. These could probably go in one category. What about the films? Well, obviously, the films could go in a category. And what do you do with Yaz? What do you do with Tom Seaver? What do you do with all these guys? And I started to find different parallels and grouping them, and it didn't take too long. Once I just kind of tried not to think about it too hard, then everything flowed.
Well, part one of the book is Boston Strong, and it begins with the story of the marathon bombing and the reaction to that, and how the Red Sox responded and how that bonded them even more with the town. And then in many ways, that's a great kickoff for the book too, because it really tells the story of the connection between not just the community of Boston, but the region, all of New England, and the Red Sox.
Absolutely. There was no question in my mind that the marathon had to be chapter one. It's so resonant. It's still affecting Bostonians. You talk to them, they well up, they tear up. And I had to have that the same way I knew that the last chapter would be the oral history chapter, the interviews with the fans. That really is the secret sauce to the book, because we can all research and go on databases, go to microfilm, read books, but to get the fans' input on the emotional aspect of the Red Sox, what the Red Sox mean to them, every story was different, but every story was the same.
I'm sorry, Bruce. I was going to say, I really enjoyed the chapter two on the Jimmy Fund, because we knew Ainer Gustafson quite well. Ainer used to come here to the station back in the day when we would participate in the Jimmy Fund radiothons.
That was a necessary chapter as well. I knew that there were certain things I needed in this book, because discerning baseball fans like yourself, New Englanders, will certainly be reading this and looking for those topics, but I had to go beyond what I could find on a website at Dana-Farber or on Wikipedia, certainly, because I never really trust Wikipedia as a source. So I went back to when the Jimmy Fund originated on a radio show broadcast and tried to find microfilm of Boston papers from that week. And sure enough, I found accounts of the show, and then you start to see how the Jimmy Fund affected New England. People were raising money for the Jimmy Fund, not in big quantities, because it wasn't the Goliath in charities that it is today. This is when it first started. So that was a real education for me.
One of the things about that chapter that really resonated with me is I used to work out at Sugarloaf and the competition crew, and every year we put on a thing called the Celebrity Cup, and Boston celebrities and athletes would come, and it would raise $250,000 in a weekend for the Jimmy Fund. And the guys who were so dedicated to that were Jim Lonborg, Mark Fidrich, Steve Nelson, Linkaitis, guys from all different sports in Boston. And when you would ask them, and they were spending money, and they got swag, but they were spending money, and they would always say, I never, ever, ever understood how important it was to do this until I went to Dana-Farber, or I went to this hospital, or I participated in this. And I think so many New Englanders now, from seeing that, have a very different idea about charity.
Absolutely. And I was so happy when I watched Fever Pitch again for the book. Jimmy Fallon's character has Red Sox memorabilia all over his apartment, and there's a big sign for the Jimmy Fund. That just really ties the character to Red Sox lore and history.
Chapter 2 of the book, part 2 of the book, History and Tradition, and I love the chapter on Songs of the Sox, and I found myself thinking, are there other teams in Major League Baseball or any professional sport that have so many songs associated with them? And I couldn't think of that many.
I don't think there are any teams that date back as far as the Red Sox do when it comes to music. It was such a prevalent part of the team in the early years, and I was really lucky to find those sources. And the same thing with Narragansett. It's just a part of the culture of New England. It's a part of the culture of the Red Sox. You talk to Red Sox fans of a certain age, and they remember Kurt Gowdy, High Neighbor. They remember drinking the beer. They remember the billboards and the ads. Bruce, I know you gave a wonderful, generous review of the book a couple of weeks ago, and you talked about Narragansett. It's just ingrained. It's that regional flavor that I don't think a lot of other teams have.
No, I mean, the Yankees had Schaefer one time, Knickerbocker different times, but it was always Gansett with the Red Sox. And my wife and I will still, if we see Narragansett down at the co-op, we start singing, I see the sunlight shining over Narragansett Bay. She's from Rhode Island, so that makes sense. But yeah, and I think that Kurt Gowdy, I think Ned Martin is the greatest baseball announcer I ever heard, but I think it's because he came after Kurt Gowdy. I think that he learned so much from him. And I've always thought, I'm a diehard New York Yankees fan, that the Red Sox always had better announcers.
And I didn't know the story either about Gowdy, because he was a little bit before my time. I knew him when he was the national star doing every sport going. And it was great to read in the book about the decision that he made and why he made that decision. And it wasn't so much about being a big-time national broadcaster. It was to be able to spend more time with family.
Sure, if you have a choice between doing six games a week or one game a week, I think you're going to choose the one game a week if you're getting paid as much or more money and you have the rest of the week with your family. And who wouldn't take that deal?
We're talking with David Krell about his new book, The Fenway Effect, Part 3, Hollywood and the Red Sox. It was so great, but it was so touching. To read, and having seen the episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, but the way Larry David handled that situation with Bill Buckner.
Absolutely. It's such an iconic episode. I think it's in my top five for Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes. It might be my number one. The way he ties everything together, the way he convinced Bill Buckner off screen to do it when he has that interview with Rich Eisen, and he talks about how he convinced Bill Buckner, well, I'll put your daughter in the show, and she wanted to be an actress. And Bill Buckner, I think, comported himself very nicely in the episode. He didn't seem nervous. He seemed like himself, like a regular guy. And I have no doubt that he's one of the all-time great guys, as Larry David said. There were no airs about him in the show, and just the way he ties it with saving the baby at the end, getting the high fives, it really is a warming experience. It's a warm moment, and Larry David is not known for warm moments on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
And of course, the story of Sam Malone is so great. New England, may everybody love Cheers, but a special place for it here in New England. And I have forgotten about the fact until I read it in the book that there were certain people in the bar who would remind everybody that maybe Mayday Sam Malone wasn't the most effective of relief pitchers at times.
Right, but in the first episode, Norm says he's the best relief pitcher baseball had.
Right.
So there's a contradiction in continuity, which often happens in shows, as you know. That's not unique to Cheers. Just watch MASH, and there are plenty of continuity errors.
Oh, there's some. Yeah, in MASH, there are lots of them. You know, I want to go just quickly back to the story of Ted Williams and the summer baseball camp. I have long known, I mean, I think baseball fans too, that Williams was an outspoken on behalf of Negro League players not being honored enough. But if you could sort of quickly tell that story for the listeners, I think they'd really be see it better.
I think you recounted it pretty nicely a couple of weeks ago. Basically, somebody at one of his camps, a coach, said something to a kid, called him a half-breed, and Ted Williams went off on him. Ted Williams was half Mexican, and he didn't like discrimination, and he didn't like that minorities weren't allowed to play Major League Baseball. And it starts when you're younger, and he just would not have any of that. Ted Williams was a guy, as far as I could see, who would judge you on your merits. He didn't really care where you were from. He didn't care how much money you had. He didn't care anything about anything except your ability and your passion to play baseball. And that goes for the coaches. You know, it's your ability to coach. It doesn't matter where the kid comes from, what his background is. Coach the player. If he's good, make him better. If he's lousy, make him good. And I that's the sense that I got from that passage from the person who was interviewed for the book. And I was really lucky to get that story in there.
It was so great in your chapter on icons. I did not expect to find a piece on Tom Seaver, but how terrific that was, and how great it was for Red Sox fans at the time to have this legendary pitcher going out one last time in what turned out to be a memorable season for the team. And he didn't put up the best numbers, but having Tom Terrific roll out there every fifth day was a great thing here in Red Sox Nation.
I did not expect that to make the final cut because he was only with the Red Sox for half a season. And I was very moved when I wrote it because I said, well, how am I going to really capture what Seaver meant to the Red Sox? And I said, oh, here's what I'll do. He didn't play in the 86 series because of an injury, but what if he could have played? Let me see if I can draft a fantasy sequence here. And I wrote what I thought Vince Scully might say in introducing the World Series with Tom Seaver on the mound. And that was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with that. When you do a nonfiction book, you don't get a lot of opportunities to do that. But I was really fortunate to get that in there. And I wanted to remind people that this is how Tom Seaver ended his career, because we remember him with the Mets. We remember him with the Reds. Some of us may even remember him with the White Sox, where he got his 300th win. But the Red Sox is where he played his last game. That's the team that he played his last game with. So to chronicle that and remind people about 86 and that year, putting him in that context was nothing short of magical for me as an author.
I think, David, one of the many things that sets this book apart from the average baseball book is your final section when we hear from the fans.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I put the word out to Facebook, Twitter, the Boston chapter of the Society for American Baseball Research, friends and family, and I got back not paragraphs in response to my questions. I got back pages, and I mean not 2 pages, 8 pages, 9 pages, 10 pages. They were so effusive, and I had to go back to each and every one and say, I can't use everything. I have to truncate this. There could be a book just in the oral history of Red Sox fans. But I had enough where I could take salient parts from each and separate them. I couldn't have five people talk about the 75 series. So you had to make choices on what to include. And I'm telling you, I've never had an experience in research like I did with this book. I know teams are tribal. I know fan bases are passionate. But there is something uniquely emotional about the Red Sox and New England. And I have a feeling that if you go to Fenway Park and you don't know about the Red Sox, maybe you don't know anything about baseball, but you go to a game and you shake somebody's hand and you introduce yourself and you do that 10 times, I bet you have 10 invitations for dinner that night. That's the community of Fenway Park. It's palpable. I'm not exaggerating this. I went to opening day last year. It's palpable. It's in the air. You can feel it. And the only experience that I can liken it to is from what people told me about the Brooklyn Dodgers when I did a book called Our Bums. And they said Ebbets Field was the centerpiece of Brooklyn. Ebbets Field defined the community. Whomever you were, wherever you came from, whatever neighborhood, whatever religion, didn't matter. You were a Dodgers fan. I think it's the same with the Red Sox, and maybe more so than just about any other ball club.
I have to tell you, too, as somebody who came of age as a baseball fan in that 1967 season that our friend Bob Ryan calls the season that saved the Red Sox, to go back and read your account of those games, particularly down the stretch in August and September, it brought back so many memories of, 9-year-old me sitting there keeping the score while listening to the radio broadcasts.
Well, let me give a shout out to the Boston Public Library. I went there for 3.5 days and just sat in front of the microfilm machine uploading as many articles about these topics that I could. And the 67 series, for sure, that took an entire day because back in those days, you'll recall, there were several editions of the newspaper per day. So you might see the afternoon edition. It would be the early afternoon edition, and it would have 2 innings recounted. Then cut to a couple of hours later, and it would be 5 innings recounted, and so on and so on. Now I guess people just look at the apps and look at their phones. But people went down to the newsstand and were getting the if they weren't listening to the radio or watching television, they were going to the newspaper to get the latest recounts, and it was just a joy to go through. It's almost like time travel when you go back to 67 or 46 or 86 and just go through these archival newspapers and organize them and read them. You really get a sense that, okay, this is what Bostonians were reading every day with their coffee and toast. This is what they were reading every morning, a recount of this paper, of that paper, and so on. And I had to put myself in that mindset to do the job as a researcher. I couldn't have done it without the help of the Boston Public Library.
Well, as always, a brilliantly researched and just a wonderful read. Even a dedicated pinstriper like Bruce was raving about the book when he read it. So it's terrific. The Fenway Effect, the newest from David Krell. David, as always, great work and wonderful to have a chance to talk with you here on the program.
Thank you for your generosity. I appreciate it.
Hi, David.
Take care.
That's David Krell talking about the Fenway Effect here on Sports Lit 101.